Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 373. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Presbyterian Church up in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you today. We've got a full panel and an exciting one at that. Let me introduce to you first our regulars. We have Adam York. Welcoming Adam back. He's the pastor of Providence OPC in Kingwood, Texas, which is in Northeast Houston. Welcome back, Adam. It's great to have you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here today, Camden.
We also have with us Jim Cassidy, who is an organizing pastor working at South Austin OPC in Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you as well.
As always, Camden, good to be here.
Yes, yes. And today we're welcoming to the program for the very first time Rita Cefalu, who is the adjunct assistant professor of theology and religious studies at the University of San Diego. She's also a graduate of Westminster Seminary, California, Wheaton Graduate School, and she's also a PhD candidate at Queen's University, Belfast. Welcome to the program, Rita. It's great to speak with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, we are very excited to speak today to Rita because we're going to be talking about her recent article in the most recent issue of the Westminster Theological Journal. It was previously delivered at a regional ETS meeting, but this is a subject I believe that many people are going to be interested in, especially our listeners and readers, and we're going to get into it today. The title of the article is Royal Priestly Heirs to the Restoration Promise of Genesis 3:15. A Biblical Theological Perspective on the Sons of God in Genesis 6. But before we open up that article and talk about everything that's in there, Old Testament themes, biblical theology, we're going to be talking about Meredith Klein and his views. We do, of course, need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. And as I mention every week, but it's no different today, that we rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and our readers and viewers to help us distribute all of our programs and all of our theological resources free of charge. We love doing what we do, but we're volunteers and we need your help as an organization to continue doing what we do and bringing you rich theological content each and every week. So visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. You can give a one-time gift. You can sign up for a recurring gift of any amount and all sorts of different frequencies. And of course, most of all, we encourage you to pray for us and to provide your suggestions on how we can best serve you. So that's our desire. So if you're able to help and like participating in what we're doing, then visit us online today, reformedforum.org/donate. We want to thank you so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Rita, when I got the new edition of the Westminster Theological Journal in my mailbox, first thing I do is I open up the front cover, I look in the table of contents, and I read those, and I look in the back and see what the book reviews are. But when I came across your article, I was very excited to see it and encouraged to see just a rich biblical theological treatment. That was one of the first, if not the first article I read. I think I might have also looked at Vern Poitras' article too, but can you speak to us a little bit about what drew your attention here to Genesis 6 and Genesis 3:15 and this subject in particular?
Well, thank you. Yes, I actually came across this while doing my doctoral research because my research has to do with the relationship between the book of Proverbs and Genesis to Kings, the primary history of Israel. And so I spent a lot of time actually in Genesis, maybe a couple of years, probably deeper and longer than you would normally, but given that it's a dissertation project, I went very deep. And it was in that process that I actually saw these links. Of course, reading Klein's article helped spur on further thoughts regarding that. And so it was really for his article that kind of got me, as well as my exegesis in Genesis, that got me to see these connections in a very rich way. Mm-hmm. So it was my dissertation work, actually, that led me to see this.
I can certainly resonate with that. I was reading Klein for some help with my own dissertation, and I must say he is a stimulating author, and the more I read, the more ideas I have for other projects I want to do. Mm-hmm. And it's almost kind of a trap. I end up with more of a pile of things that I'd like to get to because Dr. Klein is such a wonderful mind and a stimulating biblical thinker. He just opens up new vistas for you every time you open his works. Well, let me read Genesis 6:1-4, if I may, to help set the context for all of the listeners. If any of the listeners are not driving or exercising on a treadmill somewhere, I would encourage you also to open up your Bible. But Genesis 6, 1 through 4 says, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, 'My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown.'" And of course, Genesis 3:15, the Proto-Evangelium, which speaks about the coming of the seed of the woman who would redeem Adam and Eve, and it's the wonderful promise of the gospel in its first shadowy form, but no less true. I must say that we receive a lot of questions through our email on the website, and they're usually about all sorts of different subjects. But one that is a recurring subject is Genesis chapter 6, and particularly who the sons of God are, and how do they relate here to the daughters of man? What kind of relationship do they have, not only to each other, but also to the Nephilim and the giants later on? Who are those mysterious figures? In college, I first heard of this passage in terms of its kind of wacky interpretations. Rita, what are the general views that have been advanced regarding the identity of the sons of God here in Genesis 6? Who are these mysterious figures?
There are many views, but the three main that I would actually draw attention to that have probably received the most press would be the Sethite view, the idea that the sons of God are actually the lineage that descends from Seth, who is the replacement child of Abel, whom Cain killed. Not that you can never replace a child, but in terms of the seed of promise. So the Sethites is one of the views with respect to who the sons of God are. The second is, and this is the most prominent view now, apparently, in scholarship, would be the angelic view, that these are angels that left their proper domain and saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and so they married them, they had relations with them, and then produced the Nephilim. And then the third is what Dr. Klein posits, and that is the divine kingship view. And so what he does is he looks for an explanation that would go beyond an angelic view and still look for a human origin with respect to the identity of these people. And he looks at the ancient Near Eastern background to make that case, and he finds it there in the idea of divine kingship, that oftentimes within the ancient Near Eastern worldview, humans were designated as kings to rule on behalf of the deities in a polytheistic world. And so he sees that this is rather a title that is ascribed to human kingship. And he then goes to the line of Cain to identify these sons of God as tyrants who are just taking women in marriage indiscriminately, marrying many women more than one. So polygamy is their offense. And so he argues on that line that these are actually humans, and they descend from the line of Cain. They will appear again after the flood, coming from the line of Ham or Canaan, become the Canaanites. And so he argues that they're just basically tyrants. And those are the three main views that I've actually addressed in this article.
Help us maybe understand these views and perhaps the Sethite view with respect to what Meredith Klein is doing.
Sure. The first thing that Dr. Klein does is he sets out his article, and he actually has four major points that he makes. And the first is with respect to the difficulty of the Sethite view. He finds that one of the difficulties is that they take the Ha-Adam, the reference to man or humankind, in verses 1 and 2 of Genesis 6. The first part would be the Ha-Adam would be concerned all of humanity, as man began to multiply upon the face of the earth, etc., and daughters were born to them. And then in verse 2, traditionally the Sethite view has taken the daughters of men to be the Canaanites in particular. So that's problematic because you have the sort of collective term of mankind in verse 1, and then now you're singling it out. In verse 2, it changes to be just the line of the Canaanites, the daughters of the Canaanites. So he actually solved that problem by just saying, if you're talking about it collectively, that the sons of God are just drawing from women from both sides without discrimination, i.e. from both the lines of their own line, the Sethites, as well as from the genealogy of Cain. So you can solve that problem in that way. Mm-hmm. But his big issue, I think, as he starts out, is the concern that he has with respect to why what he calls a religiously mixed marriage between the Nephilim and the sons of God, or excuse me, not Nephilim, between the sons of God and the daughters of men, the Sethites and the Cainites and others, would actually produce such large people, the Nephilim, Gibberim, which he calls them. And he kind of creates a compound there, Nephilim, Gibberim. But if you look at the text itself, it's actually in verse 4, the Nephilim are the designated group that's already there, it appears, from the actual reading of the text. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And it says, and also afterward, so presuming we're speaking of the flood context here, we have Nephilim, these people, they're hard to identify who they are because they only appear twice, that word, within the Hebrew Bible. So who are they? You know, they were on the earth in those days, contemporaneous probably with what's going on in verses 1 and 2. And then also afterwards, probably after the flood, it's being referred to here. When the sons of daughter came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men, or the Gibberim, right, who were of old, men of renown. So it appears to me that the statement is being made that they did not produce these Nephilim, the sons of God and the daughters of men, but that the Nephilim were already present. And what happened was they probably had activities with them as well, which produced mighty men, if you will, Gibberim. But to bring them together as Nephilim, Gibberim, I think is to confuse the issue somewhat. It's to make them one and the same. And so I'm not sure that the text is actually saying that the sons of God created the Nephilim with their union with the daughters of men, but rather to say that they were there already on the earth. And probably, again, the sons of God had interrelations with them and bore children to them as well. I think that's what the text is stating. why it's there in particular, why that's an important point that needs to be made is not clear. But I think it's clear. Maybe perhaps you would differ with this, that it doesn't appear that they are the product necessarily, but they're already there when that happens. So that's... He says, unless we can overcome that difficulty of why these marriages between the sons of God and daughters of men would produce giants, or, you know, you can even say tyrants, then he says, we'll have to just put the Sethite view away, if we cannot explain that. And I just actually think, just right off the bat, just to start by saying, well, I think they were already there. They didn't produce them. But, and that's a commentary, it's sort of a narrative, the Nephilim were on the earth. Narrative, adding additional material. The
parenthetical phrase.
Yeah. So that's his first, he opens up with the difficulties with the Sethite view, and it would be the Ha'adam that I referred to, mankind, how you take that in verse 1 and 2, and then also the difficulty of the product produced by these unions. And so from there, he will go into the point 2 of his article, which will be the divine kingship concept, which I love. He goes into the ancient Near Eastern background of, first he starts off, well, of course, the Bible, the Hebrew Bible in this particular period, primeval history, you look at the ancient Near Eastern background, and you do see it, this notion of divine kingship, where humans were believed to be representative of deities and placed there to be sort of mediators between humankind and the polytheistic deities of that period. But he starts off with the Bible, showing also that we have biblical support for this concept of humans being sons of God. And, obviously, he uses Psalm 82 as a great reference. I agree with him there. I don't think those are speaking of angels. I think they are speaking of human magistrates that are called sons of God. And God is, taking an issue with them in the psalm because they are not exercising judgment. They're not defending the rights of the widow and the orphan. And I think that's a strong argument contextually to show that, you don't see angels really defending the you know, the rights of a widow or orphan. And these are what these judges, who are called the judges of Israel, called sons of God in this. So he develops that. He looks to extra-biblical evidence. He looks to Jewish interpretations. He looks that even some of the Jewish interpretations had that these were noble sons of God, and they married inferior women. The daughters of men were a lower class. That was that particular interpretation. So he moves to that, and then he moves to the dynasty of tyrants. That's his third point. And this is where he now moves to a contextual reading of Genesis 1 through 6, where we've been so far. And he observes in the genealogy, he goes from chapter 6 back to Cain's genealogy, which is in chapter 4. And he mentions Cain, and he mentions Cain's Enoch, the son that's born to him, and how Enoch is the first to build a city. Well, actually, sorry, Cain builds the city and names it after Enoch. And so he notices that you have this idea of Cain's genealogy and engaging city building. And I think this is very, very important to him. This is why I think he believes that these guys are the sons of God, the Canaanites. And so keep that thought in your mind as we develop this. He also sees thematic parallels between the actions of Lamech, which is in particular one of the descendants of Cain, and the way that Lamech marries women, you know, just takes women and marries them, polygamy, and boasts about his murderous exploits. And so he's exercising some kind of tyrannical power. And so based on these, the genealogy that there, as well as the thematic parallels, Klein concludes that the sin in view that displeases God in chapter 6 has to do with polygamy and tyranny. And they produce the Nephilim Gibberim. Again, he uses that as a compound term. And on this basis, God will eventually send the flood, because not because of this just specific, but it will result in greater violence upon the earth, which will then, God will then send forth the flood. Then secondly, he goes to A&E, ancient Near Eastern texts, in support of this dynastic reading. And he looks at the Sumerian flood story, as well as the Sumerian king list. Now, this is what I think really drives his argument, because the Sumerian king list does speak about when the gods decided to lower kingship from heaven, and they placed that kingship in cities. And there were five cities that are noticed. There were several others, but it's very interesting that the gods decided to give a boon to humanity. Humanity was, prior to that, referred to as living with the animals in a low state of nakedness, kind of echoes of, you know, Genesis in a way.
Yeah.
They had difficulty with agriculture, God cursing the ground. So you do hear some of these echoes of ancient, you know, something in man's mind that can remember way back to the beginning. And then as a boon to humanity, the gods lowered kingship. And you have this lowering of kingship established in cities, both before the flood and after. Kingship is again lowered from heaven again after the flood. And so I really think that's why he picked Cain as the likely candidate and Cain's offspring, because they are the first to build cities. Mm. And you have that, you know, Cain building the city, naming it after Enoch. You have Lamech and his boasts and so forth. Whereas the line of Seth do not build cities. You don't have them building cities. So I do think this city building idea is his linchpin for this argument that goes back to Cain, as well as the contextual parallels that he saw between the actions of the sons of Lamech taking wives, and the sons of God taking wives, and just their tyrannical, what appears to be tyrannical behavior. So that's just sort of a summary of his overall argument. He then goes on to develop very beautifully biblical theology from kingship there in primeval history up to Abraham. And he does state that kingship is reinstated after the fall with, and I quote him here, intimation that it would be realized in a soteric accomplishment of the Lord, end quote, page 200 of the article that I have. So, you know, he's got this beautiful biblical theology. He sees that God is going to, you know, reinstate kingship at some point. And he ends on that beautiful note with Jesus, of course, the son of his love, actually doing that. But, he sees, I think it's because of the Sumerian king list, the ancient Near Eastern material, which would make sense, absolutely, to link these kings, if you're looking for a human identity, back to the Cainites because of the city building and even the activity that appears to be going on there, just sort of tyrannical behavior, if you will.
Right. You make the point in the article that Klein does that he will go to extra biblical sources and evidences and phenomena to try to understand the Bible. He never does so in terms of trying to undercut the Bible's ultimate authority. It's always his foundation, but
absolutely.
Throughout much of his work, he will often look as a man trained in Oriental studies. Yeah. They will look at what is going on in other cultures, in Ugaritic cultures, and what's going on in extra biblical literature and the covenants and treaties that were common at the time. Because Israel also lives in this area. And it's not to say that the Bible somehow is subjected to these extra-biblical sources, but since we're removed from them, mm-hmm. it's helpful to look at other cultures to understand what might have been typical at the time, but to always do so, treating the Bible as the ultimate authority. So how would you say that Klein will look at those extra-biblical evidences and the data that he receives? And how does he... not incorporate it, but how does he use it to help him to see what he believes is already in the text, rather than trying to, I suppose, import or impose something on the Bible from outside? Is there a special way Klein does that?
No, yes, he definitely does that. And I'm so glad you added that, because definitely Klein is not looking to... the ancient Near Eastern worldview and to impose that on the text. Right.
The history of religion school. Yeah. He's not a student of that.
That period. I mean, the primeval history is depicting that period. And so these texts that we have that come from that period shed light on what we would call the historical background. And so it illuminates, is what it does, the text for us, and gives us an ideas that will help to further what we already hold to be true. There's a lot of work that's been done in that area, as you know. I mean, Dr. Beal, he's done a phenomenal work, the temple and the church's mission, where he uses ancient Near Eastern sources in the similar way that Klein used them, just to further illumine the text that we have, the biblical text, because it's against this background of understanding the historical context, some kind of different idea, so that we're not imposing a modern or postmodern worldview upon it, but seeking to glean from it even more of the richness that's already there. So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right to state that he's just looking to that more of just background material to help us to understand more the meaning of what it would have meant then, and then what it means to us today, so we can interpret it in that light.
Rita, moving on to the other view that you survey, which is the angelic view, which you described earlier in your article as perhaps the most popular view that's there today. Could you take us a little bit, survey just briefly the angelic view and why it is perhaps that you don't find that to be the most convincing of the views?
Okay. Well, As I was just thinking about this again and trying to give it a fair read when I wrote the article, what is the view itself? The main argument in support of the view would be the sons of God language itself is used to refer to angels in the book of Job in particular, in Job 1:6, chapter 2, verse 1, and 38, verse 7. And so it's this idea that is the reference, that these are angelic beings, because that phrase is actually used elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible. It also comes secondarily from extra-biblical texts, such as the Book of Enoch, and it talks where Enoch is actually picking up on this idea. And this is a book that's not even canonical. It's not necessary, but it tends to, because it's out there, people then move from this idea of angelic beings in support of that with the Job context. And they look at Psalms too, that like Psalm, some people read with the Psalm that I was talking about before would read it as angels. But then they look to this book, which is an extra canonical book, which does talk about that. There's a quote in 1 Enoch 6 that says, And it came to pass when the children of men had multiplied, and that's definitely a reference back to Genesis 6. Mm. In these days were born to them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them and said to one another, come, let us choose wives from among the children of men and beget us children. So you've got Enoch, the book of Enoch, actually then giving us an interpretation of that text.
Yes.
But again, it's an extra-canonical book. It's not considered in the canon of any, you know, particular, not the Jewish canon or any of the Christian canons.
Then you end up with books like Jude, which quote parts of Enoch, too. So it has this unusual kind of relationship to the Bible in that it's not scriptural itself, but yet somehow part of the milieu in an uninspired way.
I mean, it's incorporated through 2 Peter and Jude.
Yes, of course. It's inspired there. I mean, the use of it.
Exactly. Therefore, it becomes inspired in that way, that aspect of it, or whatever the quote is in that context. Mm-hmm. But you rightly pointed to 2 Peter and Jude as their reference to this. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned and so forth. Mm. But if you really read in that context, it's not speaking necessarily that angels leaving of the abode is that they actually left heaven or that they pursued women and had children with them. It's sort of read into the text based upon Enoch. So, but it has taken quite a hold in scholarship, as you know. And then I go on in my article to just, you know, make the argument that it just seems abrupt to me that all of a sudden you're reading along in the text in Genesis. You've just finished a long genealogy. Hopefully you've read it. A lot of people blow those right by those because they don't really see why they're there. But it just, this Sons of God episode comes right after we've just had this long genealogy of Adam. And it just seems odd that you would just all of a sudden interject this angelic, you know, angels being interjected into the text, multiplying with humans when you've been dealing with human genealogies, when the text is concerned to trace genealogical lines. And, you know, others have a counter for that as a mythological insertion and all that, which I don't buy. I think it is a unit that clearly links up with, you're meant to read it in context with the genealogies that come to us. And then I talk about the psalm that actually Dr. Klein pointed to, which was Psalm 82. And I argue there that those are, as I stated earlier, they are not, the sons of God in that context are not angels. They are actually Israelites ruling under God's authority. And so therefore they are designated or called sons of God in that way. And I argue that, you know, they're not, angels are never charged with defending the widow or the orphan. And moreover, they don't die. At the end of the psalm, it talks about God said, like one of the princes, you will fall or you will end up dying. Another weakness is that I've pointed out is in particular is what Klein did also. It's this idea of the immediate literary context. And I've already been talking about the genealogy as well as its broader context. And, the only place you really have the angelic, you know, the actual phrase sons of God actually refers to angels is in the Job passage. I mean, that's very clear. And so, you know, that would be also a weakness of that argument, too. Of course, you have the literature in Enoch, and you have then the way the New Testament ties that in, or some have seen that connection. But in terms of the actual narrative itself, I think it's just a weak argument. Angels are not called sons of God in Genesis either. They're called Malach. So they're messengers of God. And they do figure prominently in Genesis as well. So those are some of the arguments that I used in terms of my own, what I thought were, I think the main is just the context, literary. Of course, linguistic as well, but really literary. And I think, and I love the ancient Near Eastern concept because that's the key. It really is the key. But from a biblical point of view, that will also help us with the ancient Near Eastern background to understand that. And I am surprised that, but then not really, because there's been a lot of, I'm surprised that Klein didn't see that. But then again, there's been a lot more of research in the area of ancient Near Eastern background material for the Bible so that we can kind of get a better understanding. And recently there's a great book out by a person, J. Richard Middleton. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Called The Liberating Image, Imago Dei in Genesis 1. So he does a good job in terms of showing how the idea of the image of God is linked to kingship, divine kingship. And so, you know, you can see where this is going, this idea of the image of God as probably, and the divine kingship idea. Now, of course, we have in Reformed circles always seen that, the vice regency of Adam. But, you know, the actual term itself, even the idea of an image, or the idea, the concept of image, is actually also an ancient Near Eastern concept of humanity made in the image of God. Yes. So if the Sons of God episode comes right after the genealogy of Adam, and Adam's genealogy starts off with reference being made back again to the son, to the image of God, that Adam was made in the likeness of God, an image in the day that God created him. So I'm seeing that connection, you know, this is what we're talking about, ancient Near Eastern background, but we're talking about Adam in the image of God and God continuing that line. And it's not a line that's ruling as kings, like, you know, they're still in the image of God, even though they're fallen, but they're a line bearing the promise, as we talked about Genesis 3:15, that seed promise that God will send forth from the woman one, an individual, who will crush the head of the serpent, and in the process, he himself will be bruised. Mm-hmm. And that is what Genesis is concerned about. It wants to trace that line, that seed. And so we're watching the seed line. That's what we're following when we're following those genealogies, if we are following them. And the Toledo formula, as you probably know, which is these are the generations, is also a key throughout Genesis to help us to keep our eye on that line of promise. And so that line of promise, in my view, is being endangered with respect to losing its distinction as the line of promise. And Noah is mentioned as the only one righteous during that period of time and so forth. And so you have this idea where it's sort of like the idea of maintaining the covenant line, the line of promise in this case, for the restoration of the royal priesthood, if you will. But you have it being in danger because they're not showing that kind of discretion in their marriage partners. And I argue later too, as you read in the article, that this is not unusual, because you'll notice that when Abraham is married to Sarai, or Abram and Sarai, and Abraham and Sarah later, name changed, that she's his half-sister. So there's intermarriage there. When they send Isaac away, they send him to go marry from their clan. In the same way with Jacob, he's sent back to the clan to marry amongst them. Esau, interestingly, doesn't, and he practices polygamy. He marries from the line of Heth, I think it's Heth, and they actually are the Canaanites. So you've got all this interesting information there showing you that I think what's concerning here for God is that that the line of promise is no longer showing. It's again the Sethite view, but with a spin on it, with the idea of divine kingship, that they're not showing the discretion they should be showing. You know, do not be unevenly yoked, and they are just marrying indiscriminately, and that's what displeases God. That's not the reason for the flood, though. I mean, that just adds to a further breakdown in society, and that's what precipitates the flood, is that wickedness that grows, not just the marriage. So it's interesting, this mention of my spirit will not always strive. I can't help but think of Romans 8, you know, which talks about those who are led by the Spirit, these are sons of God. And that language that's in the New Testament, of course, I didn't develop that in this article. That would have gone well beyond the scope of it. But you have the language of sonship all over the Bible, from the old to the new. And so my view is that this group holds the key to the restoration promises. Something has to be done for humanity's condition. And it's a fallen image. Yes, it builds cities and it creates cities filled with violence. And that's why you don't see any of these sons of God coming from Adam building a city. It's going to be God that's going to have to reinstate them to that position where they can actually rightly represent him on earth. And that will take place over a long period of time, as we know, ultimately in Zion, ultimately under Solomon and the Davidic kingship. But ultimately, that will fail too. And so we continue to look for the one who will come and who will then ultimately usher in a renewed status, if you will. We are now in the image, our renewed image in the process, and we look forward to that kingdom which cannot be shaken. So I probably gave you more than you asked me for there. Sorry, Samson.
Rita, would you be willing to take us into that the second half of the article, Roman numeral 2, and then your subpoints 2 and 3 have to do with a kind of a linguistic analysis or literary analysis. The structural point 2 is structural and linguistic parallels. And then you get into something of the broader literary context of the primal history, comparing Genesis 1:28 and Genesis 9 verses 1 and 2. It was a very interesting analysis that you have there. What are you trying to do there, and how does that play into your overall argument?
Oh, thank you for those questions. Yes. Well, yes, in the Dr. Klein, going back to his argument, he had made some thematic parallels, structural and thematic parallels, arguing for the Cainite lineage. And he had noticed that the sons of Lamech are acting like the sons of God. So Cain's lineage is acting in the manner that the sons of God of Genesis 6 are. So he saw those thematic parallels. They're taking wives, and polygamy is what he assumes is happening in chapter 6, as well as what was happening in chapter 4. Well, I, based on an article, okay, I also had written by Etzlinger, he had pointed out this too, that you can actually make linguistic parallels that are even stronger than the thematic parallels Klein makes between Lamech and the sons of God. When you look at the sons of God, they saw something in Genesis 6. They saw what? That the daughters of men were good. Good is another word that's used there in the Hebrew. And so they took the Hebrew verb there. So the sons of God saw the daughters of men were good, and they took them. And then you have that, and that's Genesis 6, so you have that parallel with Genesis 3:6, where Eve saw, same word, ra'ah, that the tree was good, tov, and so she took from it and ate. And so what you have here is that parallel. I mean, this is Eve, and these could probably be the sons of God, the ones that come from Eve, if you will, from the seed of the woman. And they're actually doing the same thing she did, seeing something good, taking something forbidden, and taking, both of which result in ramifications not only for the human race, but also for the whole creation as well. So I thought that was a very interesting point that that Etzlinger had made, and that's a very strong parallel, linguistic parallel between the two episodes.
Yeah.
And then within, yeah, point three, did you want to say something? Let me...
Oh, no, I was just affirming that. I see also, I mean, that's a formula you find in other places in the Old Testament, too. I believe also with the Samson narrative in Judges or something similar. I'd have to check the actual original language, but there's certainly thematic parallels with the bee in the carcass of the lion and things like that. So it's no accident that we would see the biblical author here, the author of Genesis.
Exactly.
You know, doing a similar thing to make the connection, and the Israelites who would hear this, most notably Red, would pick up on these themes audibly, and they would be reminded of these and then invited to kind of consider the two accounts together.
Exactly. It's kind of almost a republication, if I can use a loaded term that's perhaps I shouldn't have used, but it is. I mean, there's a temptation, a seeing and eating, and a kind of another fall, not the fall, but a fall into sin theme that gets carried out and then picked up from there, and then it's also pushed through really the rest of Genesis and reoccurs a number of times throughout the Old Testament.
That's a good point.
Yeah, that actually does strengthen Klein's view quite well. What are some other textual similarities or reasons to maybe consider these two texts together?
Well, you have also within, I argued for the genealogical lines, of course. And what's very interesting is when you look at Cain's genealogy and you put it next to atoms and you look at the parallels of the names in particular, you have names that are same, that appear. There's similarities to the names in the genealogical construct, but they're also exact identical names. So, for example, you have Enoch as the first of Cain's offspring who builds a city. And you have an Enoch in Adam's genealogy. You have an Enosh, which is kind of a play on that maybe, in verse 25 of chapter 4. Wait a sec. 26 of chapter 4. So let me just read this. This is what's so neat. I love this. So you have Cain's story, how he kills Abel. Then you have what happens to him as a result, God sending him away. He goes off. He has children. He builds a city, names it after his son. And then all this offspring comes as a result, and they're very murderous and boastful and violent. And then at the end of Cain's genealogy, verse 24 of chapter 4, you have Lamech in his poem saying, if Cain is to be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech, me, 77-fold. So, you know, he kills someone for wounding him. You know, he's a tyrant, clearly. But then you have this beautiful bridge at the end of Cain's genealogy that segues into Adam's genealogy. And it says, Adam had relations with his wife again, verse 25 of chapter 4, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has appointed me another seed, that's the term used, in place of Abel, for Cain killed him. What's interesting is when she has Cain, back in chapter 4, verse 1, she doesn't call him a seed. She calls him man, Ish. And so you have a clear reference to the seed promise here coming from Eve's mouth in the narrative in verse 25. Then it goes on in verse 26 to say, to Seth, to him also a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So very clear, this line is a line that will be known for their worship of God. This is the line hearkening back to that Genesis 3:15, the promised seed. Abel was killed. He was a good seed. Cain killed him. But God has now replaced, you know, that seed with Seth. And then Seth's son Enosh is kind of maybe a play on Enoch a little bit. But even more importantly, the Enoch of Adam's genealogy, and you know this well, verse 21 of chapter 5 and through 24, we have a little extended commentary on who this Enoch was. And we find that he walked with God, which is language of one who, you know, lives in a relationship with God. We hear the walk language with Abraham, walk before me, be blameless. We hear that language in the New Testament, walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. This is someone who loves the Lord, is walking with the Lord, in fellowship with him. And we have this interesting thing that he doesn't build any city, but he's taken up into heaven. And so maybe you have the beginning of resurrection, even the idea of that in the Old Testament. So you've got these parallels, okay? And then you have another name that pops up. You have Lamech. Obviously, we've been talking about him a lot. He's the one that's boasting about his two wives, about his murder of these people that had wounded him. And then you have, in contrast to him, the Lamech of Adam's genealogy in verse 28, who actually has a son, Noah. He's the father of Noah. And Noah means rest, as you know. But he mentions in verse 29 of chapter 5, now he called his name Noah, saying, this one will give us rest from the work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground, which the Lord God has cursed. So he refers back to the curse. He knows what happened, that Adam and Eve were, because of their rebellion, their disobedience, were exiled from the garden. And God had cursed the ground. So he is a covenant faithful person. He realizes he's under God's authority. He understands the ground is cursed. His hope is in a coming deliverer. Perhaps this seed that's coming, perhaps this son I'm going to have, Noah, will give us rest from the ground the Lord has given. This Lamech couldn't be any more different than the Lamech of Cain's genealogy. So you've got this even... You put the two genealogies next to each other, you've got identical names, but the behavior of these sons could not be more different. And so I think that's also signaling, and also their emphasis, you know, mm-hmm. Enoch walking with God, he doesn't build a city. You have this Lamech who is waiting for that deliverance from the curse of the ground and hoping that Noah might be the one. So, and then of course Eve's comment that heads out the genealogical line. Oh, good, Seth, you know, a replacement, a seed in replacement of Abel because Cain killed him. And then I find fascinating chapter 5 of that heads out then the genealogy of Adam goes back to a reference to made in the image of God. So I think that, you know, this idea of divine kingship, this idea of being made in the image, Genesis 1, 26 and 28, let us make man in our image, male and female, he made them in the image of God, he created them. And back to that idea of image of God, as Middleton and Dr. Beale, many others have shown that the concept of a divine image, and again, the ancient Near Eastern background, is that humans were seen as representatives of the gods. And in this case, God created the man and the woman to be the first king and queen. And we can even see that language in what they're to do, to rule, to be fruitful. He blesses them to be fruitful, to multiply, to fill the earth and subdue it, to rule over it and subdue it. So that language, it's a language of vice regency there. And so I think that this reference back to Adam being made in the image is also a reference back to that idea of vice regency. And so it would make sense then that the genealogy we should be looking for to link up the sons of God is not Cain just because he built a city, but rather the ones that are actually acting like sons of God.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, there's so many biblical theological suggestions here and ways, different angles that you could take on this and different avenues that we could consider. One that you bring up toward the end of the chapter, and you've already introduced it somewhat with the idea of building a city, is that notion of cultural development and cultural pursuits. Of course, with Genesis, toward the beginning, you know, that cultural mandate is present in addition to the idea that Adam would be a king, or that mankind would be a king.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I'm coughing here.
Yes.
But they would be not only to rule over all of creation, but they would subdue it.
Mm-hmm.
What application might that have for the present day, and how might things have changed after the fall or even after the flood, for example?
Yeah, and that backs up even to the earlier question about how Genesis 9, verses 1 and 2, and the creation mandate, well, links up to the creation mandate of Genesis 1:28, and our Reformed, you know, typically how we have viewed the reiteration of that formula is sort of a reinstatement of that creation mandate. And I don't know. And I could, you know, this is just my idea. It may not be fully, you know, but just I draw this to your attention just to think about, and it's in the article, that I noticed when I was doing this research that when God blessed Adam and Eve, and he said to them, be fruitful, multiply, in Genesis 1:28, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it, those verbs there, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and everything on it, that when other, you know, people have noticed that seems to be a recommissioning that we see throughout Genesis and elsewhere. And for example, in Genesis 9, 1 and 2, right after the flood, God said, God blessed Noah, this is what it says, and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And we typically just read that together as though that's being recommissioning, you know. And I looked at it there's no command to rule or subdue there. Now, you can argue, well, it's implied. You can even say, well, you know, I think that's how we've taken it, sort of like he's a new Adam. But I think we have to be really careful not to just kind of flatline it, you know, a new Adam. But look at the nuances, because though humanity will fill the earth and will subdue it, God's commentary on the human heart is still bad. He says their hearts are, you know, only evil continually. So not only do we have the problem of sin that's entered the world, even as a power. Remember when God talks to Cain, he says, what's wrong with you? Why is your face so downtrodden? if you'll do what's right, won't it go well with you? And then he says, sin desires to master you, but you must, or desires to have you, but you must rule over it or master it. So you have this, it got me thinking about this idea of sin is a power that Paul talks about later. It's in the world. And humans, you know, it's going to be, and it's almost like a demonic, if you read it in the Hebrew, this sort of demonic idea of crouching at your door, desiring to master you. Something humanity has to fight, but obviously it will win the battle with Cain because he will murder his brother. So he will not have victory over this sort of mastering power now that's in the world, the sin power. And death is there. You see the genealogy of Adam, though. Adam begets so-and-so, and they live so many years. Then they all die. You have death just ringing through that genealogy as well. So you have to do death, sin, power of sin has entered into the world, death as a result of that. In God's commentary in chapter 8, 6 and 8 about the human condition, you know, is something has to be done about all those things, the heart and sin and death. So my thesis is that though humanity will go forward and multiply and fill the earth because God intends to fill it, they do not go because he intends to send the deliverer as well, the one who will crush the head of the serpent in the process to be bruised, because that deliverer will restore humanity to God's original intention. So I don't see a reiteration so much of the original. I think we forfeited that in our first parents, that status. We're not fit to rightly represent him on earth. Something has to change internally. We have to undergo a heart transplant. We have to, something akin to regeneration is what the New Testament will tell us, where we're now being renewed in the image of God. And that's according to the image of Christ, so that we are fit to rule in a vice-regency capacity. But it's very different. It's not like we don't build a theocracy here. And it's very clear. The New Testament tells us that, you know. Abraham got it. That's what Hebrews 11 tells us. He was looking for a city that was above. And that's amazing when you think about it. And that's why he didn't build cities either. He was waiting in faith for God to do that. And God would do that. With Zion, with Jerusalem, David would move the ark down. He would establish the temple. His son would build it. And that was real for that time. And that was, but it was a type. It's still pointing to something greater. And the greater city, which is to come, as Hebrews tells us and as Revelation tells us, will ultimately come down from heaven. So here we build no city. And I think, too, if we look at Romans 8 even, the whole creation longs for the sons of God to be revealed. We're called sons of God there. And, you know, it's subjected to futility, you know, and frustration. And so though we reign with him in a sense, it's a veiled reign. Like his majesty, when Jesus came, he came into our world of suffering, son of man. You think of Psalm 8, you think of Hebrews using Psalm 8. He comes into the world to enter our world of suffering, to restore our status as kings and queens and to rightly represent him. But it will be a veiled status. And that won't be fully revealed until the consummation, from my view. So
Rita, that is just so wonderful. And we need to hear that so much, as that really, you know, provides a template for us in which to view our lives, I think. There's so much spiritual insight and pastoral things to be gleaned from that. I really appreciate the hard work that you've put into this, the insights that you've brought forth, especially how, you know, building, I think, on what Dr. Klein has done within the realm of the divine kingship view, how this brings this passage back into relevance. Because, you know, I grew up with what I think Camden affectionately called the wacky view.
the sci-fi view.
Yeah. That, you know, that all of a sudden, in a rather jarring fashion, these beings appear and procreate. We don't exactly know how, but, you know, it happens. And then where does that, you know, come from and what happens afterward? And, you know, pastorally, I guess the spiritual benefit of that is, you know, maybe you're alert to all kinds of weird things going on if that's normative somehow for us now. But if the view that you're putting forward is correct, and I think that it is, it really alerts us to key issues that are not of just even a rarefied theological sort, but have some practical dimensions to them. And let me just ask you a question. Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say, like, that you, you know, already seeing the areas of agreement that you have with Dr. Klein's view, you, I think, disagree with him regarding kind of the ethnic or genealogical identity of the sons of God, namely that they are Canaanites. Mm-hmm. But I think I understand you as seeing also probably agreeing with him in terms of their spiritual pedigree, that these sons of Seth are really behaving more like sons of Cain.
Yes, I would. Yeah. And that's what saddens God, you know.
Right, right. And, you know, I think...
Well, you're acting according to the old man rather than the new, to bring it, you know, into Pauline parlance. It's similar. It's a trans-testamental language, really. It's a paradigm that we see everywhere.
The remnant, right. The remnant idea within the chosen line, you know, within even Israel, the line of Israel, not all of Israel's Israel.
Right.
And so you've got even within the line of bearing the restoration promise, that's what I call it, in Adam's line, you have individuals that are singled out as having a special relationship with God, but not every one of them is.
Right.
And so, we're down with Noah, you know, by the time of the flood. So.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the things.
And it probably necessitated the flood, you know, for their purposes.
Right. One of the things that always appealed to me, and I guess not only being a fan of Dr. Klein, but Dr. Van Til, too, who Dr. Klein was also a fan of, is, you know, really maintaining this notion of antithesis that you see going on, the antithesis being developed there in the early chapters of Genesis. And I think, you know, what you may be pointing out is that there's antithesis and differentiation, you know, even going on with what may appear to be the godly line, you know, whether they are part truly of spiritual heirs or not. I mean, they certainly are not behaving like that.
Right.
In the passage.
And you can argue again that it's the idea, obviously the work of grace is going on in the hearts of these elect individuals, but they're also coming from an elect line. And I think that's what's very important, you know. It's like the idea of the church using her losing her saltiness, her distinctiveness in a culture. And it's something akin to that. You know, these are the bearers of the restoration promise, and they're behaving like the Canaanites.
Yeah.
But then again, you have within that line a principle of a remnant, an elect remnant within it.
Yeah, if I were preaching through this, I would definitely see an opportunity to encourage, you know, the young people to be very careful regarding, you know,
their inheritance. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Their legacy, absolutely.
Well, Rita, this has been a thoroughly fascinating subject. I mean, it seems like we've only touched on the surface, but of course you could write an entire treatise on this subject, and some have been written. But I have not come across something with the lucidity of this, and not only in providing a survey, but also in detailing a particular view that is so wonderfully and biblical theologically informed. So thanks so much for taking the time to write the article, to submit it to the journal, and also just to take the time to speak with us today. It's been fascinating.
I really thank you all. You've been great. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We'll have to get you back sometime, and we'll talk further about these things. But until then, our article is found in the Westminster Theological Journal, the Fall 2014 edition, Volume 76, Number 2. Once again, if you have access to the journal, you can just pick it up. But if you have a database, you'll find it, if not already. I don't think it's in there already, but you may find it later. Royal Priestly Heirs to the Restoration Promise of Genesis 3:15, A Biblical Theological Perspective on the Sons of God, in Genesis 6, by our guest today, Rita Cefalu. You can visit us online if you'd like to find out more information, not only about our organization, but finding more other episodes on biblical theology and Old Testament. We're online at reformedforum.org. There you can get a hold of us by sending us an email. You can also tweet us at Reformed Forum. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope that you join us again next time on Christ Center.